Welcome to the Fitfluential Radio Podcast, the intersection of health, wellness, and fitness. Join host Kelly Olexa as she interviews thought leaders and world-class experts in order to demystify and deconstruct complex health and wellness topics. The goal of each episode is to provide you with actionable everyday tips and information that you can apply in your lifestyle. Now here's your host, Kelly Olexa.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Fitfluential Radio. I'm your host, Kelly Olexa, and today on the show, I am joined by Glenn Livingston, and we are talking about binge eating. Glenn is the author of a book called Never Binge Again, Stop Overeating and Binge Eating, and Reprogram Yourself to Think Like a Permanently Thin Person on the Food Plan of Your Choice. Now, as many of you know, if you've listened to previous episodes, we have started to talk quite a lot about whatever you want to call it, emotional eating, the mental side of health and wellness. And we're going to continue to talk about this because, quite frankly, whether it's negative self-talk, poor body image, body dysmorphia, eating disorders, disordered thoughts around eating, unhealthy obsessions when it comes to food or diet, these are things that are more... They're permeating the fitness space and individuals that are pursuing health more than we realize. And I think the more, I don't think, I know, the more that we talk about it, the more that it will become easier for folks suffering from this and thinking that they're the only ones, thinking that they're alone, to get help. And that's really the goal here, is so that we all can escape this prison. It can become very suffocating. It can become feeling like you're in a prison of your own thoughts when you're dealing with disordered thoughts and disordered eating concepts, if you will. So a little bit about Glenn from his official bio. As I mentioned, he's the author of a fantastic book. He's a veteran psychologist and was the longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm, which has serviced a ton of Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. He was disillusioned by what traditional psychology was offering overweight and or food-obsessed individuals. So it was really out of that, but also out of his own issues with obesity and emotional eating and binge eating, that he developed an actual study with 40,000 participants. He self-funded this, 40,000 participants. He talks about this in this interview and was able to come up with, you know, everything that he's rolled into this fantastic book that you'll have access to again at the end of the show. So I encourage you to sit back and tune in. I know that this will apply to so many of you, what we talk about in the show, both my experience, his experience, as well as what he's heard from, you know, quite a lot of these 40,000 individuals that he's had in this study. So tune in. We'd love to hear your questions after the show. If you suffer from binge eating or any kind of emotional eating episodes or issues, we will, again, be talking about this quite a lot on Fitfluential Radio in the future, and we're here to help. So please don't hesitate to write us. We'll give you that information at the end of the show. For right now, sit back and enjoy this interview with Glenn Livingston. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Fitfluential Radio. I'm your host, Kelly Olexa, and today on the show, I am thrilled to have Dr. Glenn Livingston with me, and we are going to be talking about binge eating, and he is an expert with a whole lot to share with us. And y'all know we have been discussing this in recent episodes and interviews. We've been doing some polling with our audience, and it is so much more widespread that women in particular, but also men, and I'm interested, Glenn, for you to, you know, kind of educate us on if it's just a female thing or a man thing as well. We've really had a vast majority of our audience share with us that this is a problem. Emotional eating, binge eating, stress eating, whatever you want to call it, it's very widespread. And so I'm very thrilled to have you on the show, Glenn, to be talking about this. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I've been looking forward to this all week.
I know this is going to be fantastic. And as I said, when we were chatting before we started recording, I definitely want to have you back on the show because, again, I know that the more we talk about this issue, the more people will become comfortable in, and not, I think there's a certain degree of shame that we all deal with when we know that we've been binge eating or eating in secret or any number of these behaviors. I know I have. I feel guilty. I feel ashamed. And then you don't want anybody to know about it. And the more that we make folks comfortable addressing these problems, the more that we can get past them, in my opinion. So very, very thrilled that we're going to be addressing this. What led you in your practice? Tell folks a little bit about what you do. And then what led you to, you know, start addressing this and write a whole book about it?
Let me first say that I'm no stranger to the shame. I also want to tell you that I have a number of critical insights about overcoming the shame, which are somewhat counterintuitive. But once you understand the structure of mind that seems to maintain the addiction and how to overcome it, you'll see that there really is a way to get over the shame. For the moment, I will tell you, it's a very personal story, and that what I try to do is help people turn shame into anger. Anger at the overwhelming number of forces that are aligned against us, forces and money aligned against us to create binge eating. I did a good number of years of consulting and millions of dollars of consulting for big companies, many of them in the food industry. And what I can tell you beyond a doubt is that there are billions of dollars that are going into engineering these hyper-palatable concentrations of sugar and salt and fat and starch and excitotoxins and all sorts of chemicals that are engineered to find your bliss point, which is the point of maximum attraction, but they're not really providing enough of the real nutrients and cofactors that your body needs to feel satisfaction. So they're short-circuiting your evolutionary pleasure mechanisms. And that's why people find themselves looking for love at the bottom of a bag or a box or a container. We didn't have cookies and pasta and pretzels and pizza, which is not to say people can't enjoy these things, but we didn't have them on the savannah. We didn't have them in the tropics as we were evolving for 99.999% of our history on Earth. And if you look at the animal studies about what happens when you short-circuit the evolutionary pleasure mechanism, for example, when they insert an electrode into a rat's brain in the pleasure center and they wire that electrode to a lever that the rat can push to self-stimulate, do you know those rats will ignore all their survival needs to push that lever thousands of times a day? A starving rat will ignore food. A mother rat will abandon her pup to press the lever thousands of times a day. And the studies haven't replicated in higher mammals, and I think even humans, by the way. And I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say we're being given that type of a pleasure button. And that's why we feel like everybody says, oh, well, I eat fruit and vegetables. You know, that's why we feel like we need these bags and boxes and containers more than we need the fruits and vegetables and like whole natural foods, because it's engineered that way. On top of that, there are then billions of dollars that go into advertising to make you believe that you can't live without these things. Mm. And people say that advertising doesn't affect them, but advertising affects you more when you think it doesn't affect you, because your sales resistance is down. So the industry has you exactly where they want you. And then the addiction treatment industry will tell you that you can't resist even if you wanted to. The best you can, you can't quit if you wanted to. The best you can do is abstain one day at a time. So you put those things together, and it's an overwhelming amount of money and superior force that's aligned against you. Now that, there are definitely solutions we're going to talk about today. And to more directly answer your question, I was as big a binge eater as anybody. There's nothing anybody listening has done with food that I haven't done myself. Hmm. Eaten out of the garbage, stolen my roommate's food, gotten to 7 different drive-thrus because I didn't want any one person to know how much I was eating.
That's so funny. Amen. Yeah. But all of those, but particularly that one where you think they actually remember you, which sometimes they do.
And like it really matters anyway.
Right?
Yeah. What we've discovered about shame is that the addictive mind can really be thought of as 2 different parts. It can be thought of as the lizard brain, and that's really the seat of addiction. And You can think of it as the rest of your brain, which is what makes you human, the mammalian brain, the limbic system, and the neocortex. And the lizard brain knows eat, mate, or kill. It sees something in the environment and it says eat, mate, or kill. The rest of the brain is where love and spirituality and creativity and music and long-term goals and aspirations and everything you think of as you, that's where it lives. So the lizard brain is kind of like a bodily organ. It's really not much more sophisticated than than your testicles or your ovaries. It generates a very powerful drive, but you can direct what that drive does. You really can. You'll understand when we get to the end of my story that what really eventually worked for me was learning to draw very clear lines in the sand. For example, I will only ever eat chocolate again on a Sunday. And then listening very carefully for anything that any thought, feeling, or impulse my lizard brain was generating to suggest that I would do otherwise. Now, it turns out that after a binge, after you make a mistake, a serious mistake, and you know, go overboard with food, that the lizard brain gets very active and generates a lot of impulses, including the impulse to self-castigate and self-flagellate. All those negative voices and shame and guilt and everything. The purpose of it is actually to make you feel too weak to avoid the next binge. And when you understand that, you learn how critical it is to be able to let go of that excessive guilt and shame. Having a little guilt and shame is okay. It's kind of like, if you make the analogy to physical pain, if you touch a hot stove, you need to feel a little bit of physical pain. Otherwise, you're not going to know where the hot stove is, so you don't touch it again.
Right, right.
What you don't want to do is say, oh, I am a compulsive hot stove toucher. I'm pathetic. I'm never going to be able to stop touching hot stoves. I might as well just put my whole hand down on the hot stove now. That's what you don't want to do. There are diseases which prevent people from, there's some children born in this world without the ability to feel pain. It's rare that you can keep those children alive past 4 or 5 years old. There's a function to pain in the human body, and there's a function for guilt and shame. But the lizard brain, in the process of binging, exaggerates that guilt and shame, wants you to perseverate and get stuck with it so that you feel too weak when you go to the next binge. Okay, so all that having been said, what brought me personally into this was the fact that I was a serious binge eater for 30 years. And I almost killed myself with food, literally. When I was young, I didn't think it was a problem. I'm 6'4", I'm fairly muscular. I was able to eat pretty much anything that I want to as long as I worked out for 2 or 3 hours a day. As I got a little older and by the way, I thought that was a superpower. I didn't think it was a problem. You would diagnose it as exercise bulimia these days.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you know at the time that, because see, I've had the same issues where I just kept thinking more is more. And if I'm not losing weight, then I'll just do more working out and I'll cut my calories more. And that certainly is still I don't want to say trend, something that we see a lot of still, that people think that that's the way to go. And I'd gotten to the point where every workout was 2.5, 3 hours, and I thought nothing of it.
The problem with that is that your whole life becomes about working out and eating. Mm-hmm. And you don't really have the presence of mind to think about other things and pursue other goals. And it overtakes your life. That's the problem with that. But, you know, I was 17 and who cares? I worked out, I looked great, and I ate whatever I wanted to, and one big hairy food party. So it's very prevalent today that people still do that. But when I got older, I couldn't do it anymore, both because I didn't have the time to work out and my metabolism slowed down. And I started gaining weight and my triglycerides skyrocketed. At one point, I believe they were over 1,100. I have a test from when they were 826. But they just skyrocketed. And the doctors were telling me with my genetic history, because everybody in my family was having heart attacks in their, you know, in their 40s and 50s. And they said I was likely to, you know, undercut them, have a heart attack when I was 35. And I still couldn't stop. And I couldn't, I come from a family of psychologists, and being a psychologist is very important to me. And I was working with suicidal people, and I was working with couples after an affair. And there were a lot of times that I just couldn't maintain the presence of mind to do what I needed to do. Because I was thinking, well, when can I get to the delicatessen? And dislodge my jaw and empty the contents of the trays into my mouth.
I love delis. Sorry.
Yeah, you and me both. I tried everything. I went to all of the best eating disorder specialists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous. And in the end, nothing really worked for me. It would work for a little while, and then it would get worse. I eventually, because I knew so much about doing research projects and I was getting all this money for doing these big studies, I decided to conduct my own study. And I actually wound up having 40,000 people participate in it over the course of many years.
Oh.
This is back in the days when internet clicks were very cheap. And I found three things in the study. I was looking at the relationship between the foods that people couldn't control themselves with and various personality and life satisfaction variables. And I found that people who struggled with chocolate, most people who binge, they binge on a lot of things, but it usually starts with one or two things. For me, it was always chocolate. My sister is this person who can take two little squares and fold them up back in her purse, fold the rest back up in her purse and say she'll save it for the weekend.
Ugh.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong
with her. Those people, where did they come from?
I don't know what's wrong with her.
Or people that can like go, I used to have a neighbor and she had a bowl of M&Ms on her counter and I would go visit her and no matter what was in her whole apartment, my eyes would go, you have a bowl of M&Ms on your counter? And she's like, yeah, I just nibble a little here and there. I'm like, nibble? Who nibbles? Especially on M&Ms. Where are these people? I believe that they are aliens from another life planet. Really.
A special rung of hell should be reserved for them.
Yes.
I'm just kidding. So I figured out that people who struggle with chocolate like I do tended to be more lonely or brokenhearted. And people who struggle with salty, crunchy things tend to be stressed at work. And people who struggle with bread or pasta or bagels tend to be stressed at home. It's kind of interesting. They weren't perfect correlations. And
bread, like soft and bready, that's...
Soft and chewy stuff, they tended to be... Soft and chewy starches tend to be stressed at home. And so I thought, well, now I figured it out. So now I just have to... I have to work on why I'm feeling lonely, and I could work with my patients about those various issues, and I'd be able to solve the problem. But it didn't work. I could tell you a story to illustrate why it didn't work. When I talked to my mom, who was a psychotherapist. She just passed. I said, Mom, I found this really interesting thing and I have so much trouble with chocolate and I know you do too. Is there anything in my upbringing, you know, as a therapist, as my mother, that you think could have set up this pattern? And she got this horrible look on her face and she said, you know, honey, I'm ashamed to tell you, but when you were a very little boy, maybe 1 year old, 2 years old, and you would come to me crying, I didn't always have the wherewithal to hold you and comfort you and feed you healthy things because my father, your grandfather, had just gone to prison. And I was terribly depressed about that because I had no idea he was that kind of person. I'd adored him my whole life. Your father, my husband, was a captain in the army and they were threatening to send him to Vietnam. And I was horribly depressed. And sometimes I would just sit and stare. And I got a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup. And I kept it in a refrigerator on the floor for you. And when you came crying to me, I'd say, honey, go get your Bosco. And you'd light up and you'd smile and you'd run over to the refrigerator and you'd suck on the bottle and go into a sugar coma, chocolate sugar coma. And I thought to myself, wow, that is definitely the match that struck the fire. That couldn't be more clear. If this were the movies, then Mom and I would have had a big hug and a cry and we would have forgiven each other. And then I never would have had trouble with chocolate again.
Don't we always wish it was the movies?
I wish life was like a movie. I really do. So we did have a big hug and a big cry. It was a good talk to have because I do forgive myself more knowing the etiology of what happened, knowing how it all came together. And I forgave my mom more. And we had it led to all kinds of interesting questions about what it was like for her and when did her dad go to jail and all that kind of thing that I never would have talked to her about. So I'm very much in favor of people having these emotional conversations about food. But the reason it didn't work to solve the chocolate problem was because there was this little voice in my head. And the voice said, hey, Glenn, you know what? You're right. Your mama didn't love you enough and she left a big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can go find the love of your life, you're going to have to fill that hole with chocolate. Let's go get some right now. Yippee! And I actually got a little worse. And I realized when I kind of combined that with what I was learning about the lizard brain and the way our anatomy works, that maybe trying to love yourself thin wasn't the right idea. Like up until that point, I was taking a purely psychological approach, like a psychodynamic psychological approach, saying, gee, it's not what I'm eating, it's what's eating me. And I've got an emotional hole or a spiritual hole in my heart, and I have to solve that or else I'm going to keep eating. And I put that together with what's going on in industry, and I said, well, in a lot of ways, it doesn't matter what match lit the fire. It doesn't matter why these eating patterns got set up to start with, because these foods have a life of their own. So what? I was lonely. So what? I was brokenhearted and, you know, in a bad marriage or whatever. These foods are things, I mean, they're really a drug. These supersized concentrations of pleasure that aren't available elsewhere. Another word for that is a drug. And I was not just eating for comfort, I was eating to get high with food. And that's a critical distinction because your inner lizard brain, who I decided to call my inner pig, by the way, which was an unfortunate metaphor because I later became a vegan and blah, blah, blah. But I called it my inner pig, and I decided that anything that was on the other side of the line for me would be pig slop, and I never eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And you know, for a sophisticated psychologist with all my credentials and years of consulting for big industry, that's what freaking worked, was that I don't eat pig slop, I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And it wasn't a miracle, it wasn't immediate. I had to do a lot of experimentation. I kept a journal for 8 years, and I slowly figured out the nuances, combined with reading more in the alternative addiction treatment literature, particularly about rational recovery from Jack Trimpe. About it's more like capturing and caging a rabid animal than loving yourself back to health. It's not nurturing your inner wounded child. It's recognizing that there's this voice of rationalization that makes it okay to cross the lines, and that the lines themselves have to be drawn with much more clarity than most people realize. We're taught to use guidelines instead of rules, but it turns out that you need the rules in order to be able to hear that voice of addiction. In order to hear that rational voice, that irrational voice that tries to justify why it's okay to break the rules. But this little crude technique, it started restoring my sense of hope and enthusiasm. And I'd have those extra seconds that I needed at the moment of impulse to make the right decision and kind of wake up and remember who I was and who I wanted to be. And that's how I recovered. And I had specifically decided not to, at the time, help other overeaters because I thought I was too sick myself. So I was working with couples and families and I was doing corporate consulting, but I kept the journal for 8 years and I happened to be, and you know, for the last 3 or 4 of those, I was pretty thin and almost entirely recovered. I was a minor partner in a publishing company who said, Glenn, I think other people would like to see this. And I said, you're crazy. I can't get up and say, I don't eat pig slop, but I don't let farm animals tell me what to do in public. And he said, trust me, you can. And I did. And it just took off. And now we've got 500,000 readers. And it's crazy. It's just getting super popular. And there are a lot of people out there saying, I don't eat pig slop. And I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. So that's why I do what I do.
To hear that that's what your progression was and that this is personal to you makes it even better. Because I think a lot of people might, you know, stumble upon your book or your site and go, oh, he's a PhD. He knows all of this stuff. This is going to be a lot of psychological mumbo jumbo. And it's just going to be another book and I'm not going to get anything out of it. Because to be real, like for years, I read every intuitive eating book on the planet written by all of these experts, did nothing for me. I read every biography that came out on the planet by, you know, I think one of them was Monica Seles. One was about Janet Jackson. One was Jerry Halliwell. They were all these like celebrities that I knew of that had either, you know, had these times in their careers very publicly where they were much heavier and then much leaner and they told their stories. I'm like, I'm going to find something in here that's going to help me. But usually it was just they were sharing, well, how do I eat less? And nothing ever made an impact on me. So hearing your personal journey drives this home a lot more. It certainly does for me.
Fitfluential Radio fans, I have a gift for you. And by gift, I mean the gift that truly keeps on giving. Head on over right now to fitfluential.com/membership and sign up for our now live VIP Fitfluential membership. Our Fitfluential membership is not a diet program. It's not a workout program. You will have access to learning from some of the best trainers, dietitians, nutritionists, doctors, chiropractors, massage therapists, chefs, athletes, authors. I could go on and on and on. A lot of folks that have been on this show. What our Fitfluential membership is designed to do is meet you in the middle and provide all of the education and inspiration that you need, all of the community and accountability that you crave, and everything else that's going to keep you from being one of those statistics in January. All those people that say, I'm going to get healthier this year. I'm going to live my best life. And then by the third week in January, the second week in February, all of those aspirations are gone. Don't let that be you. Go to fitfluential.com/membership and sign up now.
When you started talking about this and you've written a book and people turn to you and you've obviously impacted so many lives, is it that everybody that you have helped is using your precise words and specific techniques that you know that you are using, or do you help them find their own words?
You don't have to call it an inner pig. A lot of people, and a lot of women in particular, are sensitive to that. It's not part of you any more than your ovaries or testes are part of you. It's, you know, it's almost like saying, well, I don't let my testicles tell me what to do. I'm not going to go grab an attractive woman in the street and kiss her, you know, even though I might have that urge. It's a similar thing. But a lot of people call it their food monster. Some women call it their inner B-I-T-C-H.
I call it Bad Kelly. I just say Bad Kelly wants me to do this. It's Naughty Kelly, Bad Kelly, Evil Kelly. So in other words, what you're doing is you're recognizing that there's this inner voice inside of us, which it is. And it's, this is so interesting and applicable because so much of what I have found personally and what we're talking about on the show is that, look, here's the deal when it comes to fitness, but also the bigger picture of health and wellness. But, you know, let's get real. The reason that most people start getting into fitness is typically to lose weight. They usually, and there's most people that you would run into today, if you ask them, do you want to lose weight? Most people are going to say, 5 or 10 pounds. Some people, it's a lot more, right? But most people are interested in losing weight, particularly with the obesity epidemic in this country. It's very widespread. So that's why people are starting, right? And then they're always going to end up with issues. And it's just what we've been trying to get across at Fitfluential Radio and on the rest of our platforms is, look, if it was as simple as just exercise and eat appropriately, we'd all be fit, right? But it's not. There's a bigger picture. And the bigger picture, in my opinion, on one hand, the bigger picture of, hey, you have to know things that might be working against you, like hormones and hormonal imbalance. And if you're on a ton of antibiotics, all those types of things we need to be aware of, they factor in. But most specifically, the way that you win or address this battle, this plateau potentially, it's in your brain. It's inside of you. You can't, not all of us can have a trainer and a dietitian live with us and watch everything we do and eat. We've got to have those conversations in our mind. And to me, that's where the key to success is, because so many of us are dealing with these issues. Do you agree?
I do agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think more people are suffering from binge eating to some degree, and they don't realize it. Then what they're doing is, you know, I'm sure you've heard this with people that come to you and buy your book and maybe give you feedback. They're blaming, oh, I've tried all these diets, nothing works. But what they're really not addressing is they are binge eating. They are going through drive-thrus and buying a bunch of stuff and then throwing it away and then, you know, punishing themselves with a diet that's extreme for the next 3 or 4 days and then giving up. And it's just this bad cycle. People are not admitting that they're doing this. And then they're blaming, oh, well, I've tried every diet. I've tried every workout. I guess I just can't lose weight. Do you think that this concept or this practice of binge eating is far more widespread than maybe most of us realize?
I do think that that's true. I think that virtually everybody experiences periods where they eat way beyond their own best judgment, where they have a reversal of intent, where they, you know, had decided they were going to follow a particular diet very closely, and then they suddenly changed their mind because there was a big hairy chocolate bar at Starbucks that said, you know, hey, chocolate is a, it grows on a cocoa bean, and a cocoa bean grows on a plant, so therefore it's a vegetable. Or you know, I can just start tomorrow or any of the above. So I think that that's very true. Binge eating is widespread. I think that people don't understand just how addictive the feast and famine cycle is. The solution for binge eating is not a week of juice fasting. The solution for binge eating is regular, sustained, reasonable nutrition day in and day out for months. That's the solution for binge eating. And because people don't recognize that there's a high on both sides of the feast and famine cycle that keeps you addicted. When you're binging, when you're overeating, you're usually intaking industrial substances that have hyper-concentrated sources of pleasure. And then when you're fasting, there's the high about how quickly you can get the fat off, cleanse your body from it, you know, win the war against food that you started in your body already. And it distracts you from what is otherwise your life. You're losing your presence of mind and ability to connect to other people and accomplish your goals and contribute to society. You're not really participating in life the way that you could be when you're involved in that feast and famine cycle. And there's no reason that you have to be, at least in our society today. We live in a society where food is readily available. I mean, how miraculous it is that we can all walk down the street and buy organic produce. It's almost, it was unheard of 100 years ago. We live in a society where, ironically, we've never had more availability of healthy foods that could sustain us very regularly, but where we're caught in this feast and famine trap and get so readily addicted to it, and it's rampant. And I don't think it matters so much what portion of the population is DSM-5 diagnosable as binge eating, which, by the way, does include men as well as women. I think that everybody has a problem to a certain extent. Virtually everybody has a problem to a certain extent and could benefit from thinking through what role they want particular foods and behaviors to play in their lives and how to integrate that role into their character.
I've made a lot of progress myself in my relationship with food. It still is a work in progress. And I mean, frankly, I had an episode, if you will, earlier this week where I realized I was standing at my counter and I was eating something because I hadn't had it in my house for a while. And I was like, wow, that was so good yesterday. And I was aware while I was doing it. And I've gotten to the point where I am in touch with Evil Kelly. And I'm like, okay, what are you doing right now? You know, but I still did it. And then I started to lapse into the guilt, the immediate guilt and shame afterwards. But I'm better now at getting reasonable and going, okay, here's the deal. You enjoyed something. You went a little off course. Get back on the horse tomorrow. And that was like the first step for me, because I used to, and I'm curious if you see that a lot. I think one of the first things that can be helpful is we're going to have situations where we fall off the horse, right? You can work on your binge eating behaviors, but we're going to have slip ups, and the ability to bounce right back instead of going kind of like what so many people do. Well, I've screwed up. I've ruined this week. I might as well just, you know, blow the whole weekend and eat as many cookies and pizza and cupcakes and whatever, and then I'll punish myself next week. Do you think that's a big part of the behavior that people need to recognize and go, okay, comfort yourself as opposed to punishing yourself and, you know, bitch slapping yourself about what you did, about falling off the horse, and just calmly get back on the horse the next day? That's, to me, a big part.
I do. It's a very big part. It's a very big part. There are two seemingly conflicting mindsets that we need in order to recover. One has to do with progress, not perfection. And that's the mindset that you have when you've made a mistake. You know, if you accidentally chip a tooth, you don't go grab a hammer to bang the rest of them out.
That's a great example.
Yeah, you say, I accidentally chipped a tooth. It's serious. I want to avoid doing it again, but it was an accident. And let me forgive myself and figure out how to get back on the horse and recover from the damage that I've done. But progress, not perfection, turns out to be the wrong attitude when you're setting out towards a goal. If you talk to Olympic athletes or archers or people that climb mountains, they visualize themselves at the top victorious. If you were to try to help a little girl, like let's say you had a six-year-old little girl and you wanted her to ride her bicycle all the way to the top of a hill, you'd say, I know you can do it. I can see you on the top. Think about yourself. Think about your arms up in the air at the top of the hill, feeling so happy that you did it in one shot. And you give her all that energy and enthusiasm, and you remove the doubt and distraction from her mind because you don't want her drained by all of those doubts and distractions when she's pursuing the goal. But if she makes a mistake, you don't berate her and say, okay, forget it. You might as well just ride all the way back the other way. You say, come on, let's try again. Let's, you know, let's figure out what we did wrong. Let's get a better running start. Let's get you a little more to eat beforehand. And so when you commit, you actually have to commit with perfection. But if you make a mistake, you have to forgive yourself with dignity. Commit with perfection and forgive yourself with dignity. And for this reason, I tell people we want to use rules rather than guidelines. For another reason also, please remind me because it's important to get to that. We want to say something like, I will never eat standing up again. Because to bad Kelly, to our inner pigs, our inner lizard brains, they kind of act like two-year-olds. And you wouldn't tell a two-year-old, hey, you know, when you're a little older, I'm going to let you cross the street without holding daddy's hand. You know, and just you can look forward to how we're going to change the rules in a couple of years because you're going to be so much mature. You're going to be a big boy or a big girl. I'm going to let you cross the street without holding him. No, you say to them, you can't ever, ever, ever cross the street without holding my hand. And the reason you do that is it's too dangerous. You don't want them distracted by the possibility. It's the same thing with Bad Kelly. Bad Kelly operates from your lizard brain, which is really operating at the level of a two-year-old. And you need those very clear lines in the sand, those very clear rules, even though you know you could change the rule later on if you want to, and you can say, well, I will never eat standing up again unless I'm at a party with a friend, right? Or, you know, other than the weekend or something like that. Or maybe you eliminate the rule altogether because you're the boss of you and you can make any laws that you want to. But going through the process of thinking through what role you want that behavior or food to play in your life, making a very clear rule about it, it's really critical. The reason that the rule is more important than a guideline, because it's prevalent in our culture today to say, well, just try to avoid having chocolate 90% of the time. You can have it 10% of the time. That's true. That's a good guideline. But it requires that you make a decision every time that you're in front of a chocolate bar. And the problem with decisions is that everything we know about willpower now is that willpower is a fatigable muscle that's worn down over the course of the day by every decision you make. Not just food decisions, by the way. People have trouble resisting marshmallows after they do math problems. So any decision that you have to make wears down your willpower. When you create a rule, you're really making a statement of character. When you say, I'll never eat standing up again, what you're really saying is, I'm not the kind of person who eats standing up, or I'm becoming the kind of person who doesn't eat standing up. Mm-hmm. See, character trumps willpower. If you walk into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table and the waitress says, hey, I'll be right back, I just got to get you a menu, and nobody would see you take the $20 bill, there's no video camera, there's nobody up front, there's no window, there's no way you'd be seen. Virtually everybody I talk to says they would never take that because they're not a thief. And I'll say, so as a matter of character, you've instituted a rule for yourself that applies in every situation like this, and you don't have to exercise your willpower because that decision's already been made by your character commitment. And they'll go, oh, I see. And I could do that with food too. And I'll say, yes, you can.
That's actually really cool. And it's something, it's interesting. I read a book earlier this year, I think it was the Audible version on willpower. And it was extremely, I didn't expect to learn that just what you said, which is willpower. It's almost like, you know, if you fill a glass of water and you empty a little bit out through, there's only so much willpower and you can, you know, take advantage of it and use it in the right way. The other thing too, that as I'm listening to you, I love that you said, think about how you see yourself. Like, I'm not the type of person that can't control themselves over food. And that to me goes back to what I wrote earlier when you were talking, which is, I think big picture, what a lot of what you're saying and what I found has started to work for me is it's changing our attitudes towards ourselves, the way we see ourselves and the way we treat ourselves. Because again, that's that mental thing that nobody else can see. They can't see that if we're at the gym and we're looking at ourselves in the mirror, we're going, oh my God, you look hideous. You're disgusting. Everybody must be staring at you. You would never say that out loud, or you wouldn't say that to another person, but we'll let that dialogue go on in our brain. And this is all about treating ourselves like the temple, like our bodies are a temple, treating ourselves like we're valuable, treating ourselves like we're a human being who deserves to be respected and nourished and fueled, and changing the way you look at yourself, you know, giving yourself that, hey, I'm somebody that deserves to have a fantastic, healthy, vibrant body and soul. And this is what I'm going to do for myself versus this is what I'm going to do to myself because I've been bad. Changing those attitudes. And I think for me, the more I've had that inner dialogue and I've said, okay, this is what I'm doing. I want to treat myself better. I want to have, then I'm more open to the rules. And one of the simplest rules I thought I would share with sweets, I have a sweet tooth that won't die. I mean, it's like a separate friend. It could be like Kelly squared inside of me. It's a sweet tooth. It's always there. And what I've found is my rule that works for me is I can have dessert. I can have sweets, but I have it at a restaurant. I don't have those sweet snacks in my house because if I do, I tend to get into a situation where it's a trigger. And that's the rule that tends to work for me. Do you think that that's a good rule?
Well, it's working, so obviously it's good.
That makes sense.
A lot of people who feel out of control with a particular industrial food are able to conditionally manage it if they take the time to think through what the boundaries really are. So, you know, you think of an archery target, you have the bullseye, but then you also have the second rung around the bullseye. And a lot of people have different rules for when they're in a restaurant than when they're at home. A lot of people have different rules for the weekends. They have different rules for a party. For some people, never is a lot easier than sometimes. I personally can't eat chocolate. Personally, I tried six ways to Sunday. I tried every rule you could think of, and I just can't eat chocolate. And I'm a lot happier without chocolate in my life than trying to figure out how I can do it, because the misery that ensues when I do eat chocolate is just too horrendous. But I would say for 80% of the clients that I work with, some type of a conditional rule tends to work with them. And it's all about engineering the maximum amount of freedom for yourself that allows you to accomplish your health and fitness goals. It's not about becoming restrictive or, you know, being a food Nazi or anything like that.
Number one, I'm going to see if I can have Glenn back on the show, because I think we've, again, just scratch the surface, and I know we're going to have a ton of people writing questions to us about this topic, and we'll give you that email in just a second. But I think the big thing for me, a big takeaway from this, there will be many for many of you, is try to start developing a more reasonable attitude, a more reasonable attitude towards yourself, a more reasonable attitude towards, you know, hey, instead of saying I've got to lose this much weight by 2 weeks from now, give yourself the year and just say, this is my year. I'm going to start learning more and treating myself better. Calm down. The people that we've had on the show who have had major issues with disordered eating and gotten past them, and some of them are very young. I was very surprised, but I just sense in them, and I hear in these interviews, they went from being completely irrational and freaked out in their behaviors to being more calm and more reasonable. And I think that's a big takeaway to get folks started. So that said, Glenn, what I'd like you to do is let folks know where they can find you online. Where can they find you online? Social media, but also where can they find your book? Because I know so many people are going to want to jump all over that.
Well, I'll get you a free copy of the book at neverbingeagain.com. If you click on the big red free bonus button and you sign up for the reader bonuses, we'll get you a free copy of the book in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format.
Wow.
And we're trying to reach as many people as we can. It's also available in paperback and Audible, but there's a charge for that. Then we have two other important bonuses. There's a set of food plan starter templates, because we recognize that people follow different dietary philosophies, and we want you to take responsibility for modifying them in the way that you want to. But you can get one for low carb or high carb or paleo or vegan or macrobiotic or point counters, whatever you do, there's a starter template for you. And because this technique sounds so weird and harsh in theory and the abstract, I recorded a whole bunch of coaching sessions, full-length coaching sessions, so you can hear how compassionate and empowering it actually is in practice. So just go to neverbingeagain.com, click on the big red free bonus button and sign up for the Rita bonuses. And if you reply to the email that you will get after you sign up, then those replies will eventually get to me if you need to contact me. So
very cool. I encourage everybody. I mean, I just clicked on these when we were just getting started, and there really is an extensive amount of information, and that's very generous of you to make that available. And we certainly want to work together with you so that we can reach more people with this, because I know so many men and women are dealing with these challenges, and they feel like they can't get past it, but you can with time. So this was very good. Thank you, Glenn, so much for being on the show today. We will circle back with you and have you back. For everybody listening, per what I said earlier, if you have questions on this topic of emotional eating, binge eating, anything we've covered here today that you want us to cover very specifically next time, this is going to be a recurring topic for us on Fitfluential Radio. You can email us to the email address podcast@fitfluential.com. You can also use that email address if you are interested in being interviewed on the show, or if you would like to nominate somebody to be interviewed on the show. We do consider all applications, and we'd love to hear from you. But thank you so much for tuning into this episode. I hope this was helpful for you. And until next time, we will see you guys here on Fitfluential Radio.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Fitfluential Radio. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Please visit us on iTunes and like this episode and subscribe to the podcast. We want this to be your podcast, so please head over to iTunes, write a review, and give us your feedback. Give us your ideas and even guest suggestions. For a full transcript of all episodes and bonus giveaways, be sure to visit fitfluentialradio.com. We look forward to seeing you again for the next episode of Fitfluential Radio. Peace. Please remember our disclaimer for the podcast. The materials and content discussed within the podcast are the opinions of host Kelly Alexa and the guests interviewed. This information is intended as general information only for listeners of the podcast. Listeners should always seek professional advice, and content and opinions expressed in the podcast should never be construed as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.